This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Lobbyists, they get a pretty bad name. George Franklin, however, would like to shed some light on lobbyists and corporate governmental affairs types, what they do, how they do it, and how it all fits into the making of public policy. George Franklin is an attorney. He was a lobbyist who became the vice president of worldwide government relations for the Kellogg Company. These days, he heads up Franklin Public Affairs in Kalamazoo, and he tells some fascinating stories from the trenches in his new memoir, Raisin Bran and Other Cereal Wars, 30 Years of Lobbying for the Most Famous Tiger in the World. George, welcome to Stateside.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm a big fan of your show, and I'm really it's a pleasure to be here today.
Well, thanks. I have to say, your book was a lot of fun to read. Just the title, Raisin Bran and Other Cereal Wars, and you know, lobbying for the most famous tiger in the world. I love that approach you took, and I wondered why you felt that a book that opens the curtains on lobbying was needed.
Well, you know, it's interesting. For 30 years, I got three questions, and I love to go talk to colleges, and I love to hang around students. And I got the question, how do you become a lobbyist? What do lobbyists do? And then they'd always ask, well, why does Kellogg need a lobbyist? Mm-hmm. And then the fourth aspect of it was that I started to realize I would work with a lot of very smart people that had MBAs from University of Michigan and Wharton and all sorts of elite schools. But they really had no understanding or concept of the government relations function. So I started to look into it. And it turns out that government relations is really just not taught in business school, either undergrad or grad. They just act like it doesn't exist, despite the fact that every major company in the United States has a government relations department, just like they have marketing, finance, and sales. So I thought if I could write a book that people, young professionals and students, would actually read, and I call it a plane ride overview. It's not a textbook. It's not some huge tome. But if it was something fun, they could read and get a real feel for what you really do as a lobbyist for one of the major companies of the world. So that's what I've attempted to do with this, and it's been quite an adventure for me doing it, to tell you the truth.
Well, it's pretty clear from your book. You are quite aware that lobbyists are not held in the highest of public esteem.
Right, right.
What do we not understand about what lobbyists do and why?
It's very interesting because lobbyist definitely is a tainted profession, to be kind.
Kind of like a politician.
Kind of like a politician, yeah. Up there with the used car salesman program. But the reality is lobbyists depend on trust and candor in order to be good lobbyists. It is exactly the opposite of what people think of what it entails. I can go to Senator Stabenow, I can go to Congressman Fred Upton, I can go to any senator or congressman, maybe pull a fast one time. But after that, I'm out of business. What they rely on is that when I come into that office, when I meet them in the hall, when I talk to them in the lobby, that I'm going to be truthful and straightforward, and they can trust me. And they have to be able to trust that I'm telling them the facts, the implications of what I'm asking them to do. I usually also have to tell them the negatives. I'll tell them who's going to like them and who's going to dislike them. And then they're going to make a decision based on the facts as I present it to them and other people. But it's actually the whole system is built on trust, which is exactly the opposite of the image people have of lobbyists.
What would you define as the mission of a lobbyist?
Well, if you're working for a company, it's to impact the bottom line. It's to help the company make money. That's the mission of a company. And let me digress for a second. I so often would see lobbyists that got into the business of being lobbyists as opposed to, in my case, selling cornflakes, because they get caught up in this Washington world of who's the budget chairman and who runs this committee and what's the power structure and so on. But your responsibility when you work for a company is to impact the bottom line, to help the company sell more product or in a better manner what they want to do.
And one might then say, in that respect, a strong company selling more product means secure jobs.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And and you start off with your home base always. I mean, because jobs are always the key, whether you're Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative, that all kind of gets lost in the wash quite often. And, you know, the reality is you go in, and if you can help, in this case, the Kellogg Company grow, the representatives from Michigan, House and Senate, were usually there to help you, regardless of the philosophy, because their interest was helping the creation of well-paying jobs here in Michigan.
I'm speaking with George Franklin, who is a lobbyist who then went on to become the vice president of worldwide government relations for the Kellogg Company. And his memoir is Raisin Bran and Other Cereal Wars, 30 Years of Lobbying for the Most Famous Tiger in the World. And you spend a lot of time in your book, George Franklin, addressing an issue that is very tied in with breakfast foods, and that is sugar. Can you understand why many people, most people, I would say, think it's a good thing that consumer and public health groups keep pressuring companies like Kellogg to reduce the amount of sugar in cereals? I mean, we look and see that you've got 15 grams of sugar in one cup of Kellogg's Honey Smacks or a cup of Apple Jacks. And, you know, can you see why people think advertising those cereals to kids basically turns that box of Kellogg's kids cereal into a delivery system for sugar?
Well, you know, first of all, I don't speak for Kellogg Company anymore.
Right.
But one thing I will say, the issue about advertising to children is to me was always quite interesting, is that the consumer advocates who suggest that you shouldn't advertise to children are not against advertising to children. They're against advertising what they don't like to children, which is a significant difference. And so you had, on the political front, you had the extreme left and the extreme right united against these sort of major efforts to limit advertising to children. The extreme right, or the conservatives, I mean, you don't have the extreme right, but just conservatives, they thought, you know, we don't want the government to be the national nanny. Parents are quite able to make their own determinations of what they want to feed kids. Kids have been eating these products for hundreds of years. And we don't need the government telling us what we can and can't eat and what we can and can't see. On the left, you had First Amendment advocates. And they said, well, you know, if we go down this road, where do we draw the line? These are products that have been consumed by years. People want them. They take their place in the marketplace. And are we going to limit, put limitations on company and individuals' First Amendment rights? So you had this unusual coalition of the left and the right, which was sort of the downfall of the whole effort to eliminate advertising to children. It does continue, though. I'm not saying that, you know, it is an ongoing effort. In fact, in there, I sort of tongue-in-cheek talk about it's the issue along with the sugar program that sends a lot of lobbyist kids to college, because it goes on and on. It's been going on for 50-some years now.
And it's worth getting Cereal Wars to kind of get an inside view of a system that has the government telling us, you know, cut back on sugar, it's bad for you. And by the way, your tax dollars are going to support growing sugar.
In fact, I was laughing the other day. There was a piece in the Wall Street Journal that the sugar program, I think the government has to ante up just the other day another $250 million, because what people don't know is you have a system under the sugar program that creates a pricing structure where domestic U.S. sugar is about twice the world price of other sugar. And the sugar lobby is very good at what they do. They beat the food industry, and they are able to keep these artificial controls because they have what I call the intensity of the issue. And if you're a beet farmer in Michigan, if you're a cane grower in Florida, Hawaii, just go through about a dozen, 12, 13 states where there's a big sugar industry. Those elected representatives, Republicans and Democrats, once again, as I point out, Marco Rubio voted for the sugar program the last time it came up. They will fall on their swords to keep this program, because it is the only issue that matters to those sugar growers. Kellogg, Mills, Coca-Cola, these other companies, we have maybe 12 or 15 issues. So the elected officials know that if they can't vote with us on sugar, they can help us on 9, 10, 12 other things. The sugar growers, only one counts. It's the sugar program.
Your own path, George Franklin, to becoming a lobbyist landed you on Capitol Hill when you were just 19 years old.
Right.
And I tell you, as you describe what it was like back then, it was like an episode of Mad Men, wasn't it?
It was. It was. Yeah. It was the Mad Men era. And it was quite an education at 19, 20, 21 years old to be exposed to it. The other thing is I start off the book talking about my predecessor at Kellogg, who ended up in the Witness Protection Program.
That tells you something, doesn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, people say, you know, ask me why I put that in the book. I say, well, one, I put it for two reasons. First of all, it's obviously a very interesting way to start your career, having your predecessor in the Witness Protection Program. But secondly, you see so often people, young people, go to Washington and lose their bearings. They get caught up in this world of glitz and glamour and politicians and senators and congressmen. And the only way I can put it is they lose their bearings and they forget who they are and they forget where they came from. And I think it's important for young people, young professionals, when they are exposed to Washington, you know, they have to keep it in perspective. It ends, life goes on, and it is not the end all and be all that people in Washington want to think it is.
And I'll leave it to those who get your book to get all the details of how your career ended. But if you can just briefly tell us what Karl Rove did to kind of end your career.
Well, I got fired before I got hired.
Yeah.
And which was, once again, another novel approach. I'd been asked by Carlos Gutierrez, the then CEO of Kellogg Company, to go with him when he became the Secretary of Commerce in George W. Bush's second administration. And I had, for some personal reasons, I decided, well, it'll probably be a good time to, you know, leave Kellogg. And sure, I'll go to Washington and work for Carlos in the Department of Commerce. And Mr. Rove decided that I was not a true blood Republican, or my roots weren't deep enough in the Republican Party, and I was Nix before I got there. And then it got picked up by the Washington Post, the Chicago Tribune, some other newspapers. So I like to say I'm one of the few people, you know, that got fired before I got hired and got syndicated at the same time.
There was a rather delicious plane ride you had next to Mr. Rove afterward, wasn't there?
Yeah. Then a couple of years later, I actually sat next to him on a plane, and I decided I'm not one of these people going to badger him. It's just all Washington petty politics. I never took it personally. But we actually had a nice discussion, left on a somewhat positive note, but I did have to tell him that for whatever reason, he was flying to Grand Rapids. I wasn't going to wish him best of luck because I was probably on the other team.
Well, the book literally takes you from Capitol Hill to West Michigan, where Kellogg's is, to Ground Zero with Muhammad Ali, to South Africa, all around in a really interesting read. Raisin Bran and Other Cereal Wars, 30 Years of Lobbying for the Most Famous Tiger in the World. George, it was a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I've enjoyed it.
And we should note there will be a charity book signing event for the Food Bank of South Central Michigan, part of Feeding America. And George will be there from December 17th from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. in Battle Creek at McConley Square.